It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Today we're focusing on writing about Alaska. I have two of Alaska's best and most successful authors in the studio, each of whom have told stories that take into account the terrain and landscapes, the myth and grandeur of the state, in fiction and in nonfiction. We're all current or former Alaska journalists in this room, and we've all taken different slices of the state. Ewan Ivey is perhaps Alaska's best-selling author. She wrote The Snow Child, which was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and her wonderful new book is The Bright Edge of the World, a fantastic novel that I've just finished reading and highly recommend. Tom Keziah is author of Pilgrim's Wilderness, which came out in 2013, was also a bestseller, and is also recently about Alaska for The New Yorker. And I welcome both of you to the studio.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
So, Ewan, your new book is really exciting. I really enjoyed it, and it's gotten some great reviews. And it's a little bit like The Snow Child, for those who haven't read it. There may be a few people like that out there. It's kind of a magical realist story about a child that we're not sure if it is real or not through the course of the book. And you've kind of taken that approach a little bit, again, with sort of magic and with animals coming to life, but I think, you know, even in a deeper and more compelling way in this book. And I'm interested in how that technique lets you write about Alaska. Why is that an important way for you to get at Alaska?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I, to be honest, I think part of it's just because that's what's fun for me to write about. You know, before I had written The Snow Child, I had a completely different novel set in Alaska that was sort of more modern realism, and I was about three quarters of the way into it. And frankly, I was just bored with it. I just wasn't having fun with the process. And I think with The Snow Child, I realized, like, hey, this is fiction, you know. As you mentioned, coming from a journalism background, I think sometimes it can be hard to realize that transitioning into fiction, that you can do whatever you want. So having these elements of the fantastical and adventurous, like, that's partly just selfish. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Tom, and you had, like, have written about land issues and about, you know, the pioneering spirit and about the Native American aspect of Alaska. And then in this book, you're writing about these sort of very unusual and almost bizarre characters who showed up. Did that give you a way of getting into issues that, you know, that you might not have, it might not have been as easy to get into if you'd chosen some other kind of story to tell?
Oh, yeah. I think that was what drew me first as a reporter from the Anchorage Daily News, interested in the family's, you know, struggle with the Park Service and with the community they'd landed in out in McCarthy.
And for those who haven't read the book, we should, like, remind them what the... I feel like everybody in Alaska knows who the Pilgrims were.
Pilgrim.
Yeah, but let's give a quick reminder.
Yeah. Well, they'd come up from down south and had a big family, 15 kids, and settled ultimately out in the wilderness out in McCarthy, outside of McCarthy, and got in a dispute over access with the National Park Service that kind of divided the town, and they drew a lot of support initially for their stand against federal overreach and all of the you know, classic Alaska war cries, and then gradually it came out. Gradually they fell out with a community because things were just so weird within the family, and the community itself turned against them. And then eventually the kids themselves had to escape and told the story of what had really been going on inside the family the whole time. So. You know, as a newspaper story, it unfolded over 3 or 4 years, and I really didn't know at all where it was going. But once it was all done, it was a challenge as a book to go back and tell the story from the beginning, but in a way that, you know, connected the reader with the kids and what they were going through and their effort to escape. Their you know, wilderness prison.
Yeah.
So that
was one of the things I find really compelling about the book is that the characters, all the characters, come to life in this very tangible way, and it has a very novelistic feel to it as you're describing them and their characteristics, and they sort of you get to see them very vividly. And have you're nodding, you, and I mean,
I
think
absolutely.
That's very
true
of Tom's writing in general. And I wonder if that sort of the developing human beings in the story was kind of the key to you opening up the story.
You know, it was, I guess, because the first version of the book that I wrote was about 50% longer. And my two good writer friends and my editor at Crown all agreed that it was way too long and way too unfocused. I was trying to say everything there was to say about Alaska history and politics. And they said, you have this unique story, this family that just sort of carries all those themes on the shoulders of the family story. So just stick with the family story. So it took me a long time to accept that, but it was totally the right call. And by stripping a lot of that material out, I was able to, tell a page-turning story that got at all those bigger issues, but mm-hmm. just to the extent where a reader might say, oh, that's interesting that the parks are like that. I should go find out more, instead of having to tell them everything they needed to know in this book.
Yeah. It ends up being such a dark and gothic tale. And I wonder if you see it in any way as a metaphor for stripping back some of the falsity of the pioneer Alaska myth, or if you see this family as more of an anomaly that doesn't have anything to say about that issue.
No, I think that was really what made it a bigger story and an Alaska story, was that he was using that myth to shield what was going on inside and to to draw support to his cause. So it wouldn't have been nearly as interesting. At one point, there was the national leader of the Inholders Battle Association said, "I'm going to make them make Papa Pilgrim the poster child for inholders in America." And by the time he said that, I thought, that's going to be a great quote someday.
Well, I mean, to the extent that these guys, this Pilgrim family, were kind of posers and were out there sort of pretending to do, something that was an image of the sort of a movie image of a Western or whatever. Does that say anything about the other people, McCarthy? I mean, are we all pretending when we go out and sort of live in the wild when we really don't have to?
Well, yeah. I mean, even I talked about that explicitly mm-hmm. in the first person part of the book, because I have a cabin out there and it's I'm not a Daniel Boone by any means, but it gets me out and I had to build it out there in tough conditions, and so I'm a little bit of a pioneer. But he completely was, because he was a Papa Pilgrim, was such a manipulator, he was sort of building me up as this local neighbor who would support him. Uh-huh. And I, as a reporter, was sort of cynically playing that same game back to him. And we were both, posing as these two outdoors people so that we could, because I wanted to get access to him and talk to him. So that was sort of the journalistic game going on from my end, and from his end, it was his political game.
Yeah, I like how you let that into the book and let yourself in. Without making it a complete trope, as you mentioned, a travel writer was there saying, "Oh, every travel writer's got to have some goal, some made-up goal that they're pursuing." And it's not phony in your part, but it's a real part of the book. Ewan, in your writing, you are very much an Alaskan. You live in Chicoloon,
mm-hmm. yep.
And you were a small town newspaper journalist before you were an author. And it seems like your writing is just incredibly rooted in Alaska. Do you feel like that? Like Alaska is what Faulkner wrote about the South. You write about Alaska.
Well, I do. I mean, partly just because it's what interests me and what I find this conversation really interesting, because I think that on some level, a lot of us as Alaskans and writers are sort of like in a struggle with the mythology of what this place is, So we're sort of interacting with both how we perceive Alaska and how the rest of the world perceives it. And I'm really interested in that. I find it, and I felt like in The Snow Child and the new book, I'm sort of interested in breaking down some of those ideas of how, it is beautiful here, but there's a lot more to it. And I think that a lot of Alaskan writers are sort of wrestling with that, of trying to approach it, in a more honest and maybe on a deeper level, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, well, I felt like one of the ways you did that very effectively was presenting the wilderness as being kind of menacing and at times empty. And that image at the beginning of The Snow Child, when the lead character is walking out on the ice to attempt to commit suicide is so arresting, partly for that reason. Like, this isn't like the, this isn't Disneyland.
Right.
You know, this is very real and very harsh. And all of To the Bright Edge of the World is about that. It's about sort of the harshness and the interaction between the truly wild and the, you know, no longer wild, and sort of that interface that's taking place.
Well, and I guess I do feel like that there's sort of a, I think, and I'll go on a little tangent here, but I think as we become a little more removed from the natural world as a civilization, it's so much easier to sort of romanticize it. And I feel like that's not a true appreciation in some sense then, if we can't kind of look at it, the Alaska wilderness and sort of all of its glory and terror. I guess that's sort of one of my goals or one of my interests as a writer is sort of looking at it and not trying to just gloss over it and look at it like a postcard picture, you know. But it's interesting what Tom was saying about kind of having to cut back, because I actually have the opposite problem as a writer. I tend to want to let a few sentences or things speak more volumes than it really maybe is. So for me, my editors are often saying, you're not really spelling this out, what you're really getting at. So I have the opposite thing of trying to add more in to make it more clear, because I do have themes I'm trying to address and topics that I want readers to question and think about, but I'm not always, I'm having the opposite problem. So.
Yeah, interesting. Well, what you said about avoiding mythologizing is interesting, because in a way you're using a lot of Native myth and stories in this book especially, and you know, we say biologists always tell us don't anthropomorphize animals, but here we're talking about a world where animals and human beings are sort of interchangeable in a way. I'm interested in, like, did you have any fear about appropriating Native culture in a way that might be offensive to Native people?
Well, it was definitely something I was very much aware of and cognizant of, and I think it's a really important issue. I mean, there's a lot being talked about right now about this exact topic in the literary world, some different addresses that have been made at, you know, conventions and conferences and that have really stirred up this issue. There's two things that I set out to do. One is I was really interested in how a, you know, colonel veteran from the Indian Wars would perceive these stories if he was encountering them for real. So I'm translating them through the eyes of a white person. So that was one thing. But then I also talked with people, and I feel like that's the best job that we can do, any of us, to write about people who are different than us, is to do our research. And, you know, I read as many books as I could find. My whole library is all research books at this point. And I talked to people I know and asked them really specific questions about how they felt about different issues. And so I think that's all we can do as writers, no matter whether we're trying to write from the perspective of a, you know, 1885 white colonel or any other one. So I think we just have to kind of do due diligence and do the best job we can.
Yeah. So Ellen, did you find stories from several different cultures and kind of make your own Native world?
Yeah, I mean, some of them were very specific. I mean, I have huge debt to Richard Nelson and a lot of his anthropology books I did a lot of research in. Sometimes it would just be a little sentence, you know. One of them was about women having formerly been geese, and it just kind of blew my mind, and I thought, wow, what an amazing thing. And then I was also interested in, like, I have a character who is a raven-type character, but I wasn't just interested in Pacific Northwest or Alaskan concepts of the trickster raven crow, but also the Edgar Allan Poe and the Poe, you know, the raven that we perceive as European history, you know, history of being harbingers of death and all this. So I wanted to look at all those and how we perceive the world around us, I guess.
So I was telling you the other day, I was in a Safeway parking lot, and there was a raven sitting there on a shopping cart, croaking at me and looking at me, and it freaked me out after reading your book. You know,
I had the same experience. I was at my cabin by myself, way out in the wilderness. I kind of had a little bit of a fever. I was reading Ewan's book, and I fall asleep, and then I'm dreaming all this weird stuff is going on. I'm waking up, and I have to go out to pee, and it's totally dark outside. And like, oh no, I shouldn't have read this book. It's really a creepy book. I can really imagine it being made into a movie, because, you know, there's so much sort of overhang of you know, this the unseen that's very, very menacing at times.
Okay, yeah,
I was lucky. Well done. You know, as a journalist, I got to know Peter Kalifornsky and hear his stories about ravens and from, you know, the Kenaitse tribe. And I would... I'd be outside of my cabin and I'd find myself communing with the raven in a different way, knowing those stories. But there was something about it. It took a real exercise of the imagination to sort of project myself into that raven's world. But you've done that imagining for me. So when I read your book, it just sort of it made a quick, easy ramp into that that way of thinking. And it does leave a lingering.
It's extraordinary. It's the Outdoor Explorer. And before we just talk the whole hour without telling people, I want to let you know that I'm Charles Woolforth, and I'm with two writers, Tom Keziah, author of Pilgrim's Wilderness, and Ewan Ivey, whose new book is To the Bright Edge of the World, and her other book is The Snow Child, which is very well known. One of the things that we don't want to make Ewan blush too much, but one of the very powerful things about this book is it has this sense that I think we're all aiming for as writers, is that every word had to be there. You know, that somehow, yeah, we know that you've done a tremendous amount of research, Ewan, and that's obvious, but somehow you've made it seem like you're just channeling these people and it's coming through. And as a writer, I so rarely get to have that pleasure because I know kind of how things work. Mm-hmm. And so it's a wonderful accomplishment. And I guess I want to ask about your writing process, but that always gets very, very boring because it doesn't really capture how you made that happen. But I guess my question then would be about your research process. How did you gather this information and internalize it to the level that you were then able to tell this story?
Well, and actually, I think this actually relates a lot to what Tom was talking about when you're, and I'll be curious, I want to ask him about that more too with the Pilgrim story. But I was doing a tremendous amount of research, and at times it felt like work, and at times it was just fun. I would, you know, fall down these rabbit holes online. And I have to say, I'm very fortunate that when choosing 1885 as my time frame, because all those books are out of copyright now. So on Google Books, I could look up, you know, right, Manuals of Obstetrics or whatever, and it would just, all the text would be there in its, you know, it's a primary source in
it
terms of from
resource,
the time.
Yeah.
It really is. But that being said, you're right. Like, I have so much research in my head. I could tell you more about dry plate photography than you ever want to know. Uh-huh. So I had to kind of pick, and I'm sure that Tom, do you have that same experience where you have so much information? And I guess you were just sort of talking about that, about trying to confine it down to what's relevant to the theme and the story that you want. And that was part of that cutting process that you went through. Is that what you were sort of narrowing down beyond what you knew so much more about?
Yeah. Also, when you're reporting on the scene, you're having to figure that out at the time, right? You're kind of like, pick out, who is this person that I'm talking to, and sort of get that while you're there.
Right. You can't go back and get a lot of material, yeah, afterwards, so you're trying to cast a big net while you're, well, you know, during that, you know, 48 hours that I was there at their homestead, I was filling my notebooks fast, and I didn't know which direction it was going to go at that point. You know, I knew something was weird with the family dynamic, but I couldn't pin it down, so.
And then when you had to write about it in the newspaper, you can't exactly say, there's something weird going on here, and I don't know what it is, right?
I got pretty close to, yeah, saying that. Well, I remember somebody writing a letter the next week saying, there were so many red flags in that story, I couldn't, you know, stand it. But they were just red flags. They weren't, you know, because I didn't know what was going on, and the kids wouldn't say.
It's a work of nonfiction, and so everything in it presumably is true, but there's also this process of selection. And you've done this, you've got so much more than you could possibly put in there. And so when you select it, you're sort of creating the world that you want to put on the page.
Absolutely. You know, I really realize that a lot more having done this book than I did before. I mean, who I am, the first person, you know, I'm not in that book very much, but when I do come in, I'm sort of there as a created character, because it's not my whole life. And all my passions and energies are not, you know, distilled. An editor at The New Yorker was saying the other day that the hard thing about writing is that you can't say everything in one sentence, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, you've got to pick and choose. And it was true in the details, you know, there were people who were in certain scenes that I told, and the people disappeared. I didn't write about them. So, you know, that was legit. It didn't change, you know, what I was writing about the scene, but you have to exclude things, and that becomes really important.
What was the reaction of the family after they read the book? Were they okay with it?
I think there were mixed feelings. You know, I'm pretty much okay. I'm still in, you know, touch with most of the family, and it's been good. But there were a few who were sore about it, and I think opinions have drifted in different directions since then.
I wanted you to respond to a passage from the author's note, which I found very enigmatic, a little bit enigmatic, and also probably very important. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. It comes at the very end. You're talking about your late wife, Sally, and being there looking at the view and the moon. We listen to the river, and she rests her head on my shoulder as the moon comes up in a lazy northern trajectory, its yellow light peeking through a notch in the mountains, then vanishing behind the next summit, half appearing a second time and setting again, and finally floating free, a magical triple moonrise. Or so it seemed, from where we sat. I realize now it was nothing more than the turning of the indifferent heavens. Beautiful piece of writing. Why did you begin the book with that?
Well, the book is very much about religious faith and perverted in the case of Papa Pilgrim, but also about, you know, a deep faith in a sense of redemption and grace that the kids were able to bring to bear at the end. I never imagined myself writing a book where a fundamentalist Christian family would be the heroes, you know, coming in to help save the kids. And I felt I should state my position up front that I'm not a churchgoer and a believer. But I think that there is a sort of, there are these moments when you sense your oneness in the universe and the spirit of the moment and your place in it. And I think I was feeling that watching that triple moon rise, that was a something special that the universe was bestowing on us. And then losing Sally to cancer was kind of an experience that helped me to back away from the magic of that and to see it as a much harsher universe. And so that was really just kind of stating my position about, faith in the world doing those things for us, which was certainly the pilgrim, version of God. Right. Orchestrating everything for everybody.
Well, it's very explicitly kind of a passage about disillusionment, mm-hmm. which it seems to me is really the central sort of through line of the story of the incredible disillusionment those pilgrim kids must have felt when they had this universe created for them that then turned out to be very fraudulent. And I mean, did you feel that way, that's sort of it's a story of disillusionment?
Yeah, and I think that was also meant to be a reflection on the Alaska mythology that was, you know, the sort of the shallow version of it. But I think there is a deeper way to connect. And so that's what we're trying to find our way to, and just to kind of peel away the shallow imagery on the surface.
Yeah. Well, it's a very powerful piece of writing. Even I wanted to ask you about a passage in your book, which comes out right in the middle of the book. And, for listeners who don't know, the book is what was we call in the English department when I was a student an epistolary novel, and that it's written through a series of journal entries and letters, which is beautifully done and at times very charming and at times very powerful. And so we have these the different characters speaking from their own point of view, and this is a section where Sophie Forrester, who is the wife of the adventurer who's been left behind in the barracks, she's very thoughtful, and she's very likes being alone, and she's an artist, a photographer, and she's very very interested in nature, which is great. What creates this wonderful parallel to what her husband is doing, and she's talking here about sort of the joy of being in the forest. She says, "The forest has always had such an effect on my spirits. The moment slows until I can see the intricacies, bright and pure, like removing the back of a pocket watch and seeing metal gears turning. And it just almost felt like an epigram for the book, because mm-hmm. in a sense, the whole book is about, like, how does nature work? I mean, what is this this world, inner and outer world? And sort of going to what Tom was talking about, the spirituality of that. Is there a spirituality in nature? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and absolutely, it's something that I'm really fascinated by. And I don't know if, I think this is true of a lot of writers, that I write about the things that I'm not sure about, that I have complex feelings, or, you know, I want to figure out myself. And that is something that I'm fascinated by, the idea of a sort of spiritual element of nature, but how do you align that with sort of the more gritty realities of mm-hmm. what happens out in the wilderness and how people and animals live and die. So it is something I'm really interested in, and it did give me those two different voices, because the Colonel is a much more sort of pragmatic, straightforward thinker, and I think Sophie was able to give me that other voice to sort of explore perhaps some of the more subtle spiritual elements of nature, I guess. Uh-huh.
Well, when it comes to his adventure, end of his adventure, one of his, I don't want to do a spoiler, but the major character is just killed in a totally prosaic, like, pointless way. Mm-hmm. And he has to think about that. Like, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Everything up to then has seemed to be so full of portents that mm-hmm. everything means something and everything is connected to something else.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about? Sort of this the modern and
yeah, old? Like how do we find meaning, and is there meaning? I mean, should we be looking for meaning? And I think that's one thing I found so fascinating about my, you know, the sort of trickster character, is that I think it sort of throws on its head this more Judeo-Christian idea of a spiritual presence that's sort of divvying up justice. I think in the sense of the trickster, it's more like, well, maybe sometimes it's going to be good, sometimes it's going to be bad, sometimes it's going to make sense, and sometimes it's not going to. And I found that a really fascinating idea, and kind of what Tom was talking about as well, as far as things happen that are just almost impossible to make sense out of. And I think that's a hard truth to sort of get around, I guess.
Well, go ahead.
I like one thing I really liked in your book is the implicit disappearance of that world that the explorers, as the first ones in, were able to experience, and then you have a sort of modern day exchange of letters going on, looking back at this, and clearly there are no women turning into geese and such. Happening in the present day, and so what happened to that spirit, and mm-hmm. you know, where did it go? I can't wait to read the sequel.
Well, I particularly like the fact that you didn't tie up those loose ends, and it seems like this is what the magical realist writers of Latin America at their best do, is that they simply state, this is a magical realist world, and I'm not going to explain it to you.
Right.
And if there was a flaw in the Snow Child, I felt that it was a little bit too explained at the end. Mm-hmm. That bothered me a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Respond to that.
I've gotten a lot of criticism the other way as well, that people with the Snow Child wanted an answer and didn't feel like they got it. And so it's funny. I didn't, in the Snow Child anyways, I didn't realize how open to interpretation I was leaving it, where some people think, well, clearly it's stating this. And other people are like, well, no, obviously it's stating that. So it's been kind of an interesting.
Writing
and
a book that's read by so many people must be a really interesting experience.
Well, even within my own family. Okay. Some of these discussions about what really happens in the end. But for me, that is, I mean, I feel like I have answers. I'm just interested more in the questions. And so it wouldn't make sense for me to kind of wrap things up in the end. And I guess along those lines too, about, you know, where did this world go that was described in old stories. And I'm just really fascinated with the idea of perception, that we maybe have a set understanding going into a situation, so that's how we perceive it. So, I mean, I certainly believe in science, but I also believe in bias and how we interpret the world. And so that was something I was sort of interested in as well.
Great topic. In the second half, I want to talk more about this spiritual connection that we feel to the wilderness in Alaska. I think so many of our listeners, like me, go out into the wild because it does make us feel something, and it feels like something that's deeper than just what's on the surface. But what is that? And even if you, and is it an illusion? Is it real or is it something in between? Anyway, great topic as we talk about writing about Alaska with Ewan Ivey and Tom Kazaya. Please stay with us as we continue Outdoor Explorer.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is writing about Alaska. And I've got two of Alaska's best writers with me, Ewan Ivey, a novelist, author of The Snow Child and of her amazing new book, To the Bright Edge of the World, and Tom Kazaya, who is the author of Pilgrim's Wilderness and also writes for The New Yorker, had a recent article, September 12th, about Arctic oil and the relationship of the Inupiaq people to oil. Thanks again for being with us. I think just a slight change of pace. I think it'd be interesting to talk about the experience of as a writer writing about Alaska, and then your book is successful, and then you are going around the United States, and in your case, even around the world, kind of representing Alaska, and the experience you have of sort of the odd feedback you get. And I'm sure you've experienced this as well, Tom, when you're working with editors. I'm sure the editors at The New Yorker are fairly sophisticated, but even sophisticated folks outside have some bizarre presuppositions and ideas about Alaska. And I know I've been asked to write things that didn't make sense and weren't true, and people just were really sure that they were. So let's talk about that for a minute. Ewan, I know you've traveled all over the world with your book, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and there certainly are. I mean, I think it's a lot less than it used to be. Like, when I was a kid, I think there were a lot more wrong-headed ideas about Alaska. And for good or for bad, we have reality TV shows now, which present a certain kind. So I feel like the people...
In a way, even more bizarre.
Well, there is that, true. But they don't necessarily think that we live in igloos anymore and these kind of, right. They know we're part of the United States. I mean, I remember encountering that when I was a kid, the people thinking we weren't part of the United States. But certainly, you're sort of combating... preconceptions. And I think it happens to no matter where you're from. You know, someone comes here from London, we have preconceived ideas about what that must be like to be from London. And, you know, so I think we are sort of trying to expand people's understanding of what it means to be Alaskan. But to be honest, I'm a little uncomfortable feeling like I'm a spokesperson for Alaska. Like, I always feel like I want to kind of put out there that I'm one example of how you can live in Alaska. And there's lots of people who are doing things more remotely, more self-sufficiently, more everything. There's always people like that in Alaska.
But you do live out in Chicoloon, and your husband's a biologist, right?
Yeah.
You're a lot more Alaskan than I am.
But you know what's funny is I always, and that is one way I translate, you know, if I'm talking to people from outside of Alaska and I try to describe where I live, it's remote by people's standards outside of Alaska. But if you live in Alaska, you know, we're on the road system. We can drive to Anchorage. So I feel like there is this sort of different idea of what it means to live a certain way in Alaska that we're sort of having to educate and talk about as we go around. Did you find that same as you do book clubs and different things, Tom? Are you experiencing some of that as well?
Yeah. I think, you know, I was explicitly writing about the mythology and then dismantling it
right.
to some extent. So that was fine that they had those attitudes
right.
to be dispelled, you know.
Right.
But I mean, in terms of the piece that you wrote about the Inupiaq, but what I found is that there's this whole sort of moral overlay that people put on Alaskans. And, you know, I'd be in L.A. and, you know, radio host would say, well, you know, why are these Eskimos want to use oil? Don't they care about climate change? Why are they letting their oil be used? And I've just come there on a freeway that is like, you know, 10 lanes wide of cars that are going 20 miles an hour. And I want to say, like, wait a minute. How would you, what, you put it on them? You know,
right.
Who's using the oil? And so I wonder if you've sort of encountered that a little bit too.
Well, that's why that was a great topic, I thought, mm-hmm. because it's so starkly, you know, clarifies the American problem, you know, with a culture that you could look at sort of narrowly and in isolation, but their ambivalence about oil and their love for their environment is, you know, as you know, it's the same thing that all the rest of America is facing. They just are facing it in a much more dire setting and more, you know, the stakes are a lot higher and going to come crashing down there first.
But then people kind of take what they want from that. So then some oil industry folks saying, well, look, the Eskimos love the oil industry, you know, mm-hmm. and take that.
I take that stronger. Part of the yeah. of the story, you know. Yeah, I think it was partly, you know, I was able to infer that a big portion of the New Yorker readership was going to come into the article with a kind of romantic view of the Northern Eskimo and the whaling culture. And so I was sort of aware of that going in and manipulating that throughout. But I felt it was important. You know, the opening scene is really describing Point Hope and its long, deep historical roots in the landscape. And I wanted to make that feel really real to the reader so that it would add credibility to everything that that followed, you know. So start with rooting the reader in a specific landscape and not in a kind of a Hollywood version of it, yeah. and then go from there.
I mean, Ewan, you're a little bit taking advantage of that mythology in your writing mm-hmm. By setting it 100 years in the past, which we can sort of say, okay, that's our that's the myth time. Mm-hmm. Whatever's going on now, that's then.
Right, right.
And so you're able to write about a mythic period as a fiction writer.
Right, but I mean, I think I also, you know, it's funny because the novelist Andromeda Romana Lax and I had a conversation about this once about how historical fiction is kind of interesting because it allows you to get a little distance but still talk about issues that are happening now in some way, you know, but it depoliticizes it in a sense because you're putting it back in time and it allows you to talk about it in a different way. But the truth is I'm not, you know, I'm actually really uncomfortable when I'm touring and I'm asked political questions. Like I'm not interested in talking about my politics. And I often get asked about things like global warming or oil industry. And I just don't, that's not, just because I'm from Alaska doesn't mean that I'm an expert on these issues or that I want to have a political stance on different things. I'm much more interested in themes that are a little more distant, I guess, in some way. And I'm uncomfortable with that role that I'm sometimes put in as a spokesperson for Alaskan politics or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, your book doesn't seem overtly political at all, which is, and I don't know to what extent you take any inspiration from writers like Garcia Marquez or Borges, you know, these South American magical realists who obviously you would be compared to. I mean, they were generally very political, right. Garcia Marquez especially. Although, and I think Tom and I have talked about his autobiography, you find out that, yes, he was political, yes, he was a Marxist, but actually the flow of these magical stories were coming from his childhood, and he was really mm-hmm. expressing something that was maybe not political, and you know, in some sense, the politics was an overlay. I don't know. Right. I don't know if you'd agree with that interpretation, Tom.
As much as I know his work, I yeah. would say it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but for you, I mean, this is flowing out of you in a way, and so it's not political.
Well, I mean, and I guess I feel like I touch on political issues. I got asked during an interview, like, where, at the end of the story, where do I want the reader's loyalties to lie in terms of indigenous people versus conquering people? And I uh-huh. said, that's not what I'm interested in. Like, that's, like, I feel like so often, especially, you know, in an interview situation, everything gets very black and white and sort of, you know, oversimplified.
Right.
And I guess I just feel like that's what I love about the novel form is I feel like we can, and certainly you can do it in long form fiction too, like Pilgrim's Wilderness. I think you can, or nonfiction, I think you can sort of explore bigger issues without having it become so black and white. And I feel like nothing's that simple, I guess, you know, and I think that's why I'm uncomfortable with a lot of the political discussion sometimes is I just don't see it quite. I feel like everything's, I'm conflicted about everything is the
right.
truth. So.
Well, and readers will take a very complex thing you've written in which you've tried to put all these layers of nuance, and then they'll just say, well, this book says this.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
You can't get away
it
from it.
It happens again and again. Yep,
one of the passages I found most interesting in your book was this character of Alan Forrester, who's the colonel who's making the exploration, and he's obviously a highly sympathetic character. He's our protagonist to a large extent. And then there's a page where he's writing home to the military and saying, well, if you want to destroy this native tribe, here's how you would do it. You deny them fish and you would have them starve, and that would be the easiest way, which we know it's a probably very realistic thing for him to have done. Mm-hmm. And so we're able to see him as a human being who we admire, but then also sort of as part of his times and of his job.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you picked up on that, because I think I've had some readers who have oversimplified him as a character and just see him, that I'm making him heroic. And I did want to do exactly that, is show him as human and a human product of his time and his occupation. So certainly there's things about him that are very brave and admirable, but the truth is that is part of what was happening at the time. It's colonialism. It's taking over of an entire territory and lots of groups of people. And so what comes with that? And so that was one of the tricky things I felt like I wanted to address without saying, reader, you should feel this way about it, or you should hate this person, or you should admire that person. Like, that's not, I'm just more interested in sort of the complexity of human nature, I guess, and mm-hmm. how good guys and bad guys, it doesn't usually fall quite so simply, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. How do you, and Tom, that I would say that was probably a theme in your work, although I would say that Papa Pilgrim was a bad guy.
Yeah.
All the way down.
Right.
Although it helped not to see him that way at first. I mean, it helped the drama to sort of make the glitter, you know, make it sparkle at the beginning. Did Henry Allen, the character that Forrester was based on, did in his official reports, did he speak frankly? I don't remember. It's been a long time since I read it, about how to suppress the Indians.
Yeah, and that was actually a lot of,
because they saved his life, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, which is very typical, you know, of those situations. And yes, I mean, I actually found him, the real Henry Allen, to be surprisingly progressive for his time as I was reading the reports. But he did spell out how to eradicate or control the native populations if necessary, which that's his, that's the job. I mean, that's, you know, to deny that would be sort of deny history, you know. So I personally found that whole, I felt conflicted and surprised by some of the things I was reading. And I wanted to pass that on to readers to make of it what they will, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. The Outdoor Explorer, we're talking about writing about Alaska. And my guests are Ewan Ivey, the author of The Snow Child and of her new novel, To the Bright Edge of the World. And Tom Keziah, author of Pilgrim's Wilderness, a true story of faith and madness in the Alaska frontier. And my name is Charles Wolforth. So, Ewan, I just want to broach a personal topic with you, which you're free to take on or not, but both novels that you've written have, in large part, centered on a woman who is unable to have a child. And that's obviously a really powerful and deep issue, but I'm wondering why it's come up twice.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, as I didn't expect it to come up again in the new book. And these are sometimes surprising things that happen in writing. In The Snow Child, of course, it's a central theme, and I knew that's what I was writing about. And I had some personal issues. You know, my husband and I weren't sure at first if we were going to be able to get pregnant and have a baby. And then when we did, everything was wonderful. With the second baby, we actually had a scare where they thought that there was maybe a genetic disorder that we would lose her, which was a terrifying idea, and everything worked out again fine, but it kind of did give me empathy for women who deal with this, and I was very interested in that issue with The Snow Child. Into The Bright Edge, actually, and you know, you hate to give away too much, but I didn't expect what was going to happen was going to happen. That was something that just occurred suddenly in the plot, and I don't know how to explain how that happens, but I'll say that I actually have a photograph of the baby hanging in my house. I have all the photographs that I put in the book, and that one's not in the book, so it's odd how things develop.
For readers who don't know, because it's put together out of the material that supposedly has been found in a box, there are photographs and maps, and something that I really enjoyed about it, actually. So you had photographers create these things for you?
Yeah, and some of them were actual historical photographs. Some were photographs I had taken, and I had a photographer help me age them and different things. I think partly, too, what I was interested in is Mabel is a certain type of character. If anyone's read The Snow Child, she copes or doesn't cope with the loss in a certain way. And I was sort of interested to take a completely different personality and explore how she deals with loss. And so Sophie is a very different person than Mabel in a lot of ways. And it was sort of refreshing for me to, because you spend a lot of time with these people, and whether you're writing nonfiction or fiction, in your head or in person, you're spending a lot of time with your characters. So I wanted to spend time with a very different kind of character than Mabel.
So as a nonfiction writer, I'm feeling very envious of the ability to just realize, oh, you know, this is going to happen. She's going to lose a child and just have that happen. I don't have that gift to create something that seems so real when it never happened. Tom and I have to stick with what actually did happen. Mm-hmm. Go out and get the information and put it in the book.
Right.
Have you ever thought about writing fiction, Tom? I'm just curious.
I've had pieces in drawers for years. Right. Yeah. Yes, of course.
Yeah.
All right, it's hard to bring it to life. That's an amazing gift that you have here.
Well, it's funny because I don't think it's really any different in that sense than the nonfiction. I mean, you're doing the same thing in terms of having to find the details, the quotes, the things that are going to help, you know, project this character to the reader and make them seem real. And I think you do the same thing in nonfiction or fiction. It is about a selection process, I think. You know, you're choosing which quotes to use, which traits to highlight. So I think in ways it's actually very similar. But there is a certain, I mean, I have to say, I love writing fiction because I can just throw in a couple lake monsters if I want to.
So I was just in the waiting room here beforehand reading Ian McEwan's new novel, Nutshell, which is basically the Hamlet story told from the point of view of a fetus inside the mother. So, I mean, that would be, you know, certainly something that requires a little bit of literary license, but it's an amazing, and it's sort of, you know, it's probably the next version of what Eowyn has been able to do. Right?
Well, I was asking her about her selection of topics. I'd like to ask you the same thing, Tom, because I know that as a nonfiction writer, finding the thing to write the book about is a big challenge. You wrote In the Wake of the Unseen Object a long time ago, which was about stories in rural Alaska Native village stories.
Right.
Boy, those villages probably have changed a lot since you wrote that. That was in the
80s. I'm not sure that they have that much. Yeah, I mean, obviously in some ways the technology has changed, but I think, you know, I was lucky to be reporting during the rise of tribes as the sort of new alternative to the native corporations. And I think that tension between tribes and corporations is still, you know, fundamental to what's going on in the villages. And the search, you know, and the theme was the search for how do you, you know, preserve what's good in the old and move forward as a culture and a people. And it was also a theme of how do I, as a white outside writer, understand, you know, comprehend what I'm seeing, learn and become smarter about it in the course of doing those travels. And
so what year were you doing that work?
That was late 80s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then this book was 2013. And you didn't write a book in between.
No, I was a newspaper reporter.
You're a newspaper reporter.
And a dad.
But what was your process of looking for and choosing your new topic? I think you went through another topic that you worked on and you weren't able to.
Yeah, there was a book proposal that didn't, that where the subject pulled out, but that had nothing. That wasn't actually an Alaska book, except in a sort of secondary way.
Is it just waiting for something to drop in your lap that's as good as the Pilgrim story? I mean, that's probably once in a lifetime.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, it's hard to find something that has that many sort of laminations.
I actually have a couple questions about that. I'm curious. Like, were you on the search for a book topic at that point? Or was there a certain point where you thought, oh, this is a book?
I think it's this latter, really. It was kind of delivered to me.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying it was, you know, any universal design that made that happen, but some people would.
Mm-hmm. At what point did you realize that it would have these resonances with your own life and with your sort of the things you wanted to say about Alaska? Was that inherent in it from the beginning, or did
that was right at the very beginning? You know, when I first heard about this family that was stirring up things out in McCarthy in 2003, I said, that's a great story for the Daily News, because as a reporter, I had always been on the lookout for stories that would sort of crystallize what I considered this historical moment, the sort of transitional generation that we've been going through in Alaska. And so because I knew McCarthy had a cabin out there, I knew that it was an interesting community. So it's a great setting for a story. And if you have a sort of dramatic family in the foreground and a wonderful setting like McCarthy in the background, I figured, well, that's going to be a good story one way or another. I had no idea how complicated and deep it was going to get, but I think it was my instinct right from the start that that was a combination of things that was going to, you know, say a lot about the themes that I was interested in as a journalist.
After you had decided there would be a book and you kind of sold your proposal to a publisher, how much additional reporting did you need to do in order to create the narrative that you wanted to tell compared to what you already had in your notebook?
I had to get a lot more inside the family so that I could tell the sort of second half of the book from the inside more, you know, what it was like for the kids to escape. The first half of the book is kind of from the outside where the you know, you're seeing what the family's backstory was and how they arrived in McCarthy and how that all developed up to a point. But then you go inside. And so that was important, you know, to have that sort of access from the inside. And so that required me to stay in good terms with the kids and with the mom to some extent.
I think I would just be worried about being completely overcome by darkness. I mean, it's such a horrible tale in a way.
But they did get away, you know, yeah. And it's sort of a story of the human spirit and of finding their values in a place where he kept them so isolated and so rigidly controlled over, you know, what was good and what if they did this or that they were going to burn in hellfire, and you know, they believed it because they never read any other books other than, you know, the stories he would tell them. That was their whole education. So I mean, it's more isolating than you can really believe. And yet, yeah. They found their conscience and they got out of there. And I think that's, you know, a great story.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about something we alluded to at the beginning but both of you have written about, which is the change in Alaska, and I don't know if the right way to say it is the loss of the myth or the loss of the magic. I mean, we think about McCarthy, and I think just in my lifetime how McCarthy has changed from this place that really was like a funky ghost town to when I was there a year ago. It's pretty tame. I mean, there are tourists all over the place, and it doesn't, you know, and there's the... there's a big Princess Hotel out by the highway, and you know, it's not completely, you know, like Talkeetna, where it feels like you're, you know, wall to wall tourists, which is another place that's really changed. But it's going that way, and that seems to be sort of, I don't know, the path that we're on. And Ewan's writing is certainly about sort of this poetic place becoming prosaic, And I'd like you both to sort of talk about that. Was that a theme for you in the book at all, Tom?
It was a theme in the book, but it was also, I mean, it's been a theme for my whole career. I mean, since coming to Alaska in the 70s, I saw that I was lucky to be here at the end of a historical period. And just as the oil was beginning to swamp the politics and change Anchorage and Homer, where I live, and Talkeetna, you know, this was all... It was happening, and that was my subject. I just did a piece this month in We Alaskans about an old timer from McCarthy,
yeah,
Jim Edwards, who that was the explicit theme, was that he had just passed away, and these were stories of his life out there, and it's not the kind of life we can lead anymore. And he was really, you know, the exemplar of those lost decades of Alaska history, you know, between the closing of the Kennecott mine and the coming of the national park out there, the park being kind of the exemplar of mm-hmm. of the modern world and the modern tourist attraction that it's become. That's a great subject.
Yeah. Ewan, I mean, you're younger than we are. Sense that we're talking about?
Oh, absolutely. But I don't think Alaska's unique in that way. I mean, yeah. I think cities across the country, gentrification that's happening, you know, where there's this sort of an irony that I think comes across with the Colonel's exploration, the same idea that what draws someone to a place they therefore changed by going to see it, you know? And mm-hmm. so this is, I think, happening all over the country, really. And I don't think Alaska is unique in that way. But at the same time, I think, too, we have to be careful of over-romanticizing the past as well. And I guess that's something that I feel like both in The Snow Child and To the Bright Edge, the idea of what it means to be a homesteader, what it means to you know, explore new territory, that it's easy to kind of idealize something that happened a long time ago. And I think there's good that comes with change. But I think certainly change has definitely come to Alaska. And I grew up here. So, you know, 40 some years, I've it's amazing to me how much Alaska has changed. And with that, some of it has given more opportunities to people like my daughters who can do, you know, be a part of plays and do all this great stuff. But then also you do lose some of the romantic wildness, maybe. I don't know.
Eowyn's book is about the exploration of the Copper River, right?
Yeah.
You know, in 1880s. And, you know, when I came to Alaska, my first trip, I was still in college, but I came up for the summer and we floated the Copper River in order to get onto the Miles Glacier and go mountain climbing. And there were no books. There were no guidebooks for,
yeah.
We were literally reading Henry Allen's journals to find out where were the rapids. And, you know, we were like,
yeah.
it was a different time, you know.
It was very different. And on the flip side, as Ewan says, you know, if you talk to elders about, well, what was life really like before you had kerosene and before you had snow machines and even going farther back, well, I mean, people starved to death all the time, you know, life really hung by a thread. And those elders, I guess mostly have passed away, but I asked them, well, would you go back? And they never say they would,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
Well, that was very much the theme in the New Yorker piece too,
yeah.
From Point Hope. Mm-hmm. You know, the guy I was writing about had been born in a, you know, you said, Eowyn, we're not living in igloos, but he was actually born in a, you know, sod home,
yeah.
that had one plug wired, you know, from a distant generator, and it had a single light bulb in there and sometimes an AM radio and earthen walls.
Yeah.
And they don't want to go back to that.
No. Or have the very short life expectancy or horrible health conditions and all that. So,
well, and yeah. I just really think it's fascinating. I think again and again, Alaskan writers are like I said, wrestling with these ideas. And I think Ordinary Wolves is another fantastic
yeah.
Alaskan book that looks at these exact ideas of what Seth do we Kander. Romanticize?
Yeah.
Yeah. One of my mm-hmm. very favorite Alaskan books. So I think it is a topic that we that sort of fascinates us as Alaskan writers.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank both of you. This has been such a fun conversation. I'm really glad we got to do it. Ewan Ivey, author of a book, which I recommend to everyone, To the Bright Edge of the World, and Tom Keziah, author of Pilgrim's Wilderness, one of the best nonfiction books written about Alaska. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks, John.
Thanks so much.
That's all for today's show. Our producer is Eric Bork. Our assistant producer is Hannah Doro. She helps line up the guests. My name is Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.